This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded December 23rd, 2014, episode 229, Kaiser's Kits.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And this is Jeff Kaiser of MightyOhm.com. Hey, guys.
Yes, sir.
You know you were going to get it.
Ho, 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 yes, sir.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Santa, I appear around the holidays.
Or Mr. Hankey. Well,
as I'm recording this, it is 12:45 on Christmas Eve. I know it's not Christmas Eve there, but it is here.
Well, so, you push it.
It's Christmas Eve here. Christmas Eve squared.
Right. It's a drinking night here. It's a traditional.
And we haven't had you on the show forever, it seems.
I know. Thank you for inviting me back. It feels like time has passed so fast since I was last on the show. I actually had to go look it up, and it was like late last year. So a bit over a year ago. Time really flies.
Wow, man. Wow. That's bonkers.
And you're still at Valve.
I am.
How's it going?
Yes.
Yes.
That's all he could say, folks.
I can confirm my employment status. No, actually, things are going really well. It's been a really exciting year. And I think that the last time I was on the show was just before we had sort of entered a big new phase for our project. And we're actually on kind of a couple big milestones past that now. But at the time, I think it was before we had shipped one of our early betas to users for playtesting. And so I think that at that time, compared to sort of everything I've learned since then, I kind of feel like I was a noob. And I'm still learning a lot, still super busy. But this year has been a really amazing year. And we're working on a bunch of really exciting projects. And I've been really fortunate to be a part of it and to be very central to one of the products, which I've been kind of most attached to since I started. And it's been amazing, just absolutely amazing. In fact, I just got back from a trip to the East Coast where I was visiting one of our factory facilities and got to see a bunch of equipment that's going to be used in volume production of a product that I've been working on for quite some time. And it's been totally awesome to see that stuff. So
you're
making
stuff
cool
in the U.S.?
That's a complicated answer to that question.
It always is.
Designed in the U.S., at least. We know that. That's what it always says in the back. Designed in the U.S., made wherever.
Certainly a lot of the prototyping that I do is U.S.-based manufacturing, just for the pure reason of speed.
Yep.
But when you get to the bigger quantities, it gets a lot more complicated. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to talk about a lot of that stuff next year. You know, look forward to hearing more about all of this stuff hopefully soon. And it's going to be really exciting to finally talk about a lot of it with people.
That's
and you're
great,
learning
man.
The joys of mass-produced consumer
I am.
Items.
I think this past year has been really me learning the ins and outs of volume manufacturing of consumer electronics.
Right, which
and
is so a whole other class that, too, right? I mean, that's the big thing.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. And all that stuff that they talk about, there's a lot of buzzwords, but like DFX is one of them. Mm-hmm. Everybody's talking about DFX, which is designed for excellence or just DF and then blah.
For whatever.
And that could mean designed for manufacturing, designed for test, designed for assembly, all of that stuff. I've spent a tremendous amount of time over the past year learning about how design for manufacturability, particularly on like PCBs and electromechanical assemblies, how hard it is to get that stuff right. And I won't say that I've gotten to the end of that. There's still quite a bit of work that I've got ahead of me in 2015, but it's been kind of a crash course in design for manufacturability and design for test. And it's all stuff that I wish that they taught in schools, because a lot of it were lessons that were just really hard to learn. And I think it's a combination of reasons why this stuff isn't really taught, and also why, as an engineer starting out, it's really hard to just, like, you can't just pick up a book and read about this stuff, which I wish you could. But it's been fascinating to kind of learn it in many ways the hard way.
And a lot of it's very specific to the product and the industry that you're manufacturing for. I mean, you know, that's why you can't just read a book and, oh, I'm magically a DFM expert, you know.
It's really true. And that's true for a lot of things. Like, I've spent a lot of time over the past year doing EMC and design for EMC. And that's one of those things where if you're building a medical device, there's one set of things you need to know. And if you're building a consumer electronics device, it's totally different. The laws are different or the regulations are different. The import-export stuff is different. The limits are different. And it's just like, I know one little corner of it, and it's sort of, it's what they call ITE equipment, which is basically computer and computer accessories. Like that whole sub branch of EMC, like you could spend years learning the ins and outs of that stuff and how the laws apply in different countries. So I can tell you all about like South Korea's regulatory requirements for wireless devices for 2.4 gigahertz. It's like, I know like these very specific niches.
Sorry, ladies,
but it's the kind
taken.
Of stuff. Yeah. It's the kind of stuff that you have to learn in order to ship a product, and it's really fascinating.
Can you give us any generic things that you've learned, not giving the game away of the products you're working on, obviously, but any traps for young players?
You know, one of the things that I've found is kind of universal across many different parts of manufacturing, and I'm actually curious if this is something that's been largely my experience or if this is a typical experience in this part of the industry, and that is that when you're working with large contract manufacturers or you're working with prototype houses or you're working with component vendors, it's really hard at the outset to say, tell me all the things I need to know in order to make a successful product. And I don't mean like a successful product in terms of like it does the right stuff and users like it, which really should be what we spend the most time on. But it's more like all the nitty gritty of like, you know, how far can this component be to the edge of the board? Like, really, you know, not just like tell me the minimum, like the safe limits, but also tell me kind of what you can really do. And one of the things I've found is very true for many of those types of problems is that the only way to really get the answer is to actually build it, and that you can't just ask somebody before you build it, like, hey, you know, what do you think?
Never
hey,
ask.
Person trying to sell me something, what is the primary way this is going to fail so I can buy it from you?
Exactly. But even getting that kind of wisdom of like, okay, so for someone who's built a whole bunch of products like this, like in general, you know, what would you say is a good like clearance rule for this particular situation? I found that almost never really works in a time-efficient manner. It's way better to just make a whole bunch of crazy assumptions and then go try to build a bunch of them. And that's when people will actually take you seriously and will actually say, oh, yeah, actually, you totally can't do that, and that totally doesn't work. And then you end up like kind of facepalm, like, why did you let it get to this stage where I've spent all this money and all this time? And like, you could have told me that, but I found that it seems like that's how the industry works, and that it's sort of this iterative design process by which you make a bunch of assumptions and you just have to try stuff. And in a lot of cases, you'll get to the wrong answer way quicker if you just kind of shotgun it and be like, let's just do X. So that's one of those truths that was really hard for me to learn, because I wanted to solve it the other way. I wanted to say, okay, tell me everything I need to know.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to do it right the first time and it's going to work and it's going to be perfect. It's incredibly hard to do that.
That's not uncommon in the industry, but the only trap with doing it that way, which is the most common way to do it, is that if you give, you know, make, as you said, a whole bunch of crazy assumptions about what you can actually assemble or do and give it to them, and then they give you back the finished product and they don't mention anything. They just said, you know, here's your board, you know, and
built the spacer,
everything's fine. But they it turns out that, no, they sort of like hand-soldered that part, or they did this or they did that just to get the job done, and then it's not relevant to volume manufacture until you hit like a, you know, 100,000. You know, then when you give them an order for 100,000, they go, oh, sorry, we can't really do that.
and it's amazingly hard to get that kind of feedback. And I think that's what really separates a good contract manufacturer from a bad one. And I've been really lucky to work with some really great resources on the contract manufacturing side who have taught me a lot and have helped. But at the same time, the kind of thing that you're talking about where something that works perfectly well in prototyping doesn't scale to volume, mm-hmm. I really do feel like the only way to know if this is going to work when you build 100,000 is to build 100,000, and that you're gonna learn it one way or another, and you're gonna have a lot of reason to fix it when you've got 50,000 bad units that are sitting on a shelf somewhere. So there's a lot of pressure to figure this stuff out, but it's sort of like you can't plan really for that kind of crisis enough. Like system is not set up for you to do.
We should remind people about your background too. It's like you just used to design those preamps, right? Like I think the stuff we were talking about last show with
I listened to the show last week, which was an awesome show, by the way, and all of those things about 3.5 semiconductors and gas and
I thought that millimeter might have been
wave
stuff.
ICs. That's the world that I came from and that I worked in for quite a long time. And I actually designed gallium arsenide power amplifier chips. And I think that might be where, you know, you take the chip designer and me and then you thrust someone like me into consumer electronics.
No testing it out. You can't just try it and see what happens. It's like, oh,
that's
because
right.
That cost $100,000 to do one test run.
And I think that is an interesting cultural thing. And you guys were talking about CMOS prices for a mask set. You know, when you're doing CMOS chip design, there's a huge incentive to get everything perfectly right.
Yep.
And you'll spend millions of dollars in simulation tools and you'll hire design verification engineers and all these people that kind of all work together to make sure that the thing works as designed at the outset. That really isn't true in many other, from at least in my experience, in many other branches of electronics design. It's more just build it, you know, find out what works, keep tweaking until you get it right, until you get the yields where you want them to be. And it's this very, it's a hard process and it can be very stressful and very difficult. But at the end of the day, I think that you end up being able to follow the bleeding edge of technology, right? If you were overly conservative, then you'd end up paying more for your product and you'd end up not taking advantage of the full capabilities of all of the parts of the supply chain, right? Because you'd be designing for the least common denominator.
Yep, exactly.
Oh, so you're doing some stuff in the US, but ultimately probably a lot of it's going to be done in China, right?
It's definitely a complicated picture, and I think a lot of those details will hopefully be things that we'll be talking publicly about next year.
Right.
So I'll be excited and interested to kind of share that story then. But it's still a story that's kind of unfolding as we go along. There's still a lot of work to do. And it's been interesting to see that. But I will say that, you know, the majority of PCBA manufacture is, of course, done in China. There is some that's being done in the U.S. You know, particularly you hear about companies like Apple that are building Mac Pros. There's a lot of medical devices that are built in the U.S., lot of kind of higher margin stuff. But for consumer, it's pretty hard to beat China. And there's a lot of expertise there. Pricing is generally going to be better. So you end up making decisions that are based on a lot of factors, and we've had to make a bunch of decisions along those lines. And I'm very interested to see how that stuff plays out as we you know, start building lots of widgets, which is something that is very new to me still, and has been fascinating to learn about.
A lot of late nights coming up in your future, huh, buddy?
Oh yeah,
a lot more, right? Dave knows the rigors
Christmas,
of the
New Year's Eve. Yeah, what's right. that? Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It's really it's you know, I think it's worth it. It's like it's kind of you have to go through it. I wouldn't have believed when I started that I would get to do this and that I would get to learn so much about this process. But I really do think that it's not something that you can easily be taught. I think you have to do it.
Yep,
totally. So is this the kind of stuff that Valve would want to show off at the Consumer Electronics Show, for example? Or is that not the right place?
CES
because that's coming up like first week in January, so yeah, you better get that hardware finished quick smart.
I was actually thinking about CES recently. Why is CES in January?
I think it's because
I was talking to a coworker of mine. Like, why? Who was it that decided that the biggest consumer electronics event of the year was going to be in January, such that all engineers in consumer electronics were going to have to work frantically through the holidays. Well, and not only that, but you've got all these poor sales reps that are trying to schedule meetings during the first week in January. And to be honest, like this time of the year, most people are kind of checked out, right? They're at home with their families. If they're not frantically working towards some prototype, like people are just not around. And so you've got these sales reps that are trying to coordinate meetings, and they're getting nowhere because everybody, it's like molasses, right? People are just kind of, they turn into a pumpkin and they go away for 2 weeks around Christmas time. And I think every company's different, but like, what about March? there's a lot of other times of the year that probably would be perfectly cool, and Vegas would be just as cool other times of the year. Why on earth is this the first week in January?
I don't know. If anyone knows the history, please. Well, it was started like way back in the 80s or something, wasn't it? And, you know,
I think they still had Christmas at that time, though.
I think they would have, but, you know, like it wasn't nearly as big. Like it was sort of, you know,
CES or Christmas? I think Christmas was was the same, but you might be right. I don't really get it. I mean, there's a lot of other shows that are throughout the year, and Valve goes to a couple shows pretty regularly. We've been at CES the past couple years, I think, It's for us, it's really more about like making sure that we've got the product at the point where we want to talk about it publicly, that we feel like we have something to talk about, than just going to the shows and using the shows as like milestones. Because I've actually been a part of that before at previous companies where like CES was like the event of the year, and you had to have all your stuff ready, and it was going to be a big opportunity to get funding and actually share with the world what you've been working on. And so it ends up being this big milestone to actually get a working prototype at CES. And you read about this, like all the big computer companies, like they always used to have their, like the Commodore 64 or whatever was like wired together with bubble gum and holding things together. And I think that's kind of the mentality that a lot of companies go into shows like CES with. And I think that, you know, where I work, it's a little bit different. I'm really fortunate that it's not this mad rush to get ready for CES every year.
Right. So Valve is not showing anything at CES, folks, this year coming up. Maybe you got something.
If we do, it'd be a big surprise to me. But
You go. All right. So we'll either have to wait for next CES, as in 2016, or some other show to reveal your hardware. Because what's the? I mean, you said 2015, but it's a long year, you know.
Yeah, it
goes
is,
from January
you know,
to December.
Yeah, it sure does.
Come on, throw us a bone. Throw us a bone.
No, you're not getting anything.
Damn it. He'll have HR down on him before you can know it.
No, honestly, I mean, I've been working hard this year and expecting to just keep plugging along, and there's a lot of work to do. So it's making a product takes an incredible amount of effort, and it's not something that happens overnight. It's something that takes time and a lot of really talented people to pull it off.
Well,
I'm very fortunate to work with some.
Speaking of which, I'm currently rendering as we speak, so I hope my machine doesn't crash, rendering a video, a teardown video of the Apple Lisa, the original 1983 Apple Lisa. The reason I brought that up is because it took apparently 5 years to actually develop that machine. From when they first started work on it to when they actually released it in January 1983. So it started back in 77 or thereabouts. Absolutely amazing. Just takes forever.
Wow.
And that's, you know, like people are used to, you know, product, you know, they say like the typical product design time, less than 2 years, and that 18-month kind of, you know, ballpark. Mm-hmm. Is always been the magic figure. And then people are saying, oh, it's getting worse these days. It's always, you know, it's 9-month cycle, you know, 9-month development cycle. And yeah, but no, some things can take many years. And I was surprised that the Apple Lisa took 5 years or thereabouts.
Remind me what
almost.
The Lisa is. What is that device again?
Oh, it was the Apple Lisa was the first graphical user interface Apple pre the Mac. it was actually before the Macintosh. So,
was that the one that was like a tablet, or actually it was just a
display? It's a video display. It's a, you know, it looks like the Macintosh, except it's wider. It's much wider. It's like three times the width. So, come on! I thought you guys would know the Mac, the Lisa.
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely,
Chris, yeah. Youngster.
Sorry, man.
I don't know. You weren't even born when that was out, were you?
I don't know.
Unbelievable. So yeah, it is 31 years old. So yeah, I think it is younger than.
I am also 31 years old. So
oh,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So yeah. Anyway, that took 5 years of development. You know, imagine the ins and outs over 5 years, and how, you know, imagine if you were working on that from the get go, and your product didn't see the light of day for 5 years. You know, that's a long time for an engineer to handle.
And I mean, it could be much worse, though. There's many products that have never seen the light of day that have been worked on.
Oh, yes, that was my entire career.
So
yeah.
I think I'd much
I built my career on unfinished projects.
I'd much rather have a product that came out eventually than one that just got canned. And I know engineers I've worked with that have had that happen at previous companies, and that's traumatic. I mean, you think about the number of startups that work on a product for years and then they just kind of fold
before it gets out the door.
That's too bad.
But it has its pros and cons. I mean, the bad thing is that, well, you never get to see, you know, the satisfaction of people using it and never get to see it on the shelves or whatever it happens to be, right? But the flip side of that is then you don't have to do the, you know, that last 5% of the crap work actually getting it to market, right? So you just do the cool design stuff and then, that was canned. Okay, I've done 90% of it. Yeah, that was fun. And then you go on to the next project. So you don't have to worry about, you know, dicking around with bloody production. So it has its... unless you're an aficionado of test systems and all that production jazz, you know?
Don't you love GPIB?
love what?
GPIB, the programming interface for a lot of test gear.
GPIB.
Yeah. You don't call it GPIB?
I've never heard it called GPIB before. Is that a Yankee thing?
I don't know. Just work at a test equipment company, and that's, you know.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it used to be HPIB, and then it was GPIB, right?
Yeah. HP Interface Bus.
No, it's always been spelled out
IEEE
like that,
488.
Or it's been the HPIB.
Yep.
Oh, the IEEE 488. Yeah, exactly. Oh, goodness.
So you've got 555, but not GPIB.
Right, yes.
Oh, man, that's an old conversation from the Amp Hour,
It
huh?
is a very old conversation.
Man.
Let's not go back there.
Think of me like that backup that you find, you know, years later, and it's still got
what
the files that you were
again?
Working on. Yeah, yeah,
this
you're
is
right.
The Kaiser
right.
disk.
So you could draw
it like a jazz
diagrammatically.
Drive or,
it's got those
it was
old
a PsyQuest. PsyQuest, actually, yeah.
Was it Big Endian or Little Endian? I don't remember.
I'm kind of like a bookmark for the show. And you can kind of go back and
speaking
we can
of
figure out what we were talking
555,
about.
555, are you still selling your detection kit for the...
I totally am.
Yeah?
Yeah, the Geiger counter
Geiger
kit.
Geiger counter, thank you.
Yeah, and it's been kind of a back burner thing for me because obviously I've been really busy, but I do still do a little bit of the hobby stuff on the side, and I still do the kits... but it hasn't been as big as it was years ago. Like at the time that happened, I think everybody was thinking about radiation and interested in learning about radiation and Geiger counters, and Fukushima was still fresh in everybody's mind. And so I think that meant that the first couple of years there was a huge amount of interest, and it's definitely slowed down a bit. But I've also been sort of spending less and less time on the kit business as I've had just kind of less time for projects. But it's still plugging away, and actually I just had kind of a surge of holiday orders that I just finished shipping out, that it was sort of a surprise to me. I was actually thinking, okay, this is going to be the first year that I don't have like a big holiday rush, and that'll mean, gosh, I really need to work on a new kit because this one's getting kind of, you know, long. It's been around for quite a while. But then out of nowhere, for whatever reason...
And come a flood of orders, and you go, damn it.
It came a flood of orders, yeah. And so... this year was kind of a funny year for me because I spent most of the year where I wasn't really selling very many, and then all of a sudden November, December, things got really busy again. I'm really lucky. I spend a few hours every weekend and I kind of am able to keep up with it, and it's been really fun because I actually still enjoy doing that a lot. It's really cool for me to have kind of complete ownership of a product and actually be working on optimizing the kind of really small scale manufacturing and looking at suppliers. So it's like all the same kind of stuff I do for my day job, but on a way, way, way smaller scale. And it's kind of funny to go back and like look at the design and think, oh God, you know, there's so many things that I would have done differently if I was doing that now. Designer's guilt, yeah.
I knew how many I was going to sell, you know?
You know, and that is actually a thing. Like, I'd say the number one thing that I wish I had done a better job of when I did the initial design is just using fewer line items in the BOM. Because when I'm sitting here, like, stuffing bags of components, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, why are there, like, 42 parts in this thing? I really could have gotten away with a couple fewer resistors and things like that. And I think at some point I'd like to go back and take a look at that, but there has to be sort of like this level of like, you have to be frustrated enough by it that you're actually willing to open up the design again and go and redesign things. And I haven't quite gotten to that point yet. And I feel like probably the defining moment will be when a component is no longer available. Yep. That's when you say, all right, now I've got to go work on this thing again. But it's pretty amazing. The design has held up really well, and I still get lots of emails from people that are building them and are excited that they got their kit working. And it's just amazing. I never would have guessed that when I designed that kit that I'd still be selling them now. It's just totally a shock to me. But I'm really happy that I was fortunate enough to find something that people wanted and enjoyed using and building. And also that I'm lucky to have distributors like Adafruit and the Maker Shed that are selling my stuff. It's just really cool. I can concentrate on manufacturing and ship off products and they sell them. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's really cool. It's fun.
And that's always the trap, isn't it? You go, well, how many more of these bloody things am I going to sell? You know, like it could dry up, you know, and like it's not worth the design respinner. It's so not worth ordering another 500. I'm going to order 50 instead. You know?
I felt that way the first couple years that I was doing this. And I think that the first build I did was 30 kits. And I was like, I don't know if I want to build like 100. I don't know if I want to build 100. It's like, that's a lot of components. Yeah. It's a lot of money and Geiger tubes and all this stuff. And, you know, I've sold a lot more than 100 kits by this point. And I think that the message to that is, I think it is good to kind of play it safe the first year that you're doing this. But if you're still selling, you know, pretty good quantities, like a year or two out, like that's when you do like I do and start buying things in like the 500s and thousands. Like you just buy a lot. You buy a year's supply of stuff to get the cost down at the distributors, and you end up buying stuff overseas, and you can afford to wait because you're not like waiting on a day by day basis for components. Mm-hmm. And so it lets you do things like that really help. It helped for me, like my most precious commodity is time. You know, as somebody that does this kind of on the side now, it's not the majority of the work that I do. For me, I really have to optimize so that when I've got time on a weekend and I can sit down for a couple hours, that I've got all the components ready to go and I've got everything there. And so I do tend to like overbuy and just make sure that on any given weekend, I've got something I can work on, be it, you know, clipping wires or stuffing bags or putting labels on. And so you have to kind of queue up work weeks in advance such that at any given time, I've got something that I can do to try to make forward progress. And that's worked really well for me.
That's why I'm surprised you're still doing it, actually. I mean, like, that's like, that's not how I think you have to be my free time, to be honest.
So you have to be a little bit nuts. And I think that I have become a little bit of, I've become maybe a bit of a workaholic, and it's definitely been something that I enjoy doing it, and so I want to do it more. And it is hard sometimes to keep up all the side projects and also, you know, keep, because my day job can be pretty intense as well. And so trying to balance all this stuff has been challenging, but I've pulled it off, and it's been a lot of fun doing that. And that's not even including kind of the other projects. I've been working on a lot of non-electronics related stuff recently.
Like?
Well, come on, man. We didn't ask you here just to, you know.
But I thought this is an electronics-themed podcast.
Just give us a list, and then we'll hear if there's anything that we want. You'd be surprised how many people accuse us of not being electronics podcast.
Oh, well, so what I've been spending a lot of my time recently is actually building engines. And I've got a couple old cars, and I think people that know me know that I'm into kind of old 70s, 60s cars. And as of this year, I had never actually built an engine before. And so this year I decided that for the first time, I'd been wanting to do this for years, I was actually going to rebuild an engine entirely myself. You know, I was going to have all the machine work done, obviously, by a professional because I don't have all the equipment, but I was actually going to do all the assembly and all the checking and everything myself. And it's something I've always wanted to do, but I'd always thought, oh gosh, that's going to be like a year-long project and it's a huge amount of work. And it turns out, it is a year-long project, exactly. And it is a huge amount of work. But it's also incredibly rewarding. And it's one of those like multidisciplinary things where to build engines, you need to learn how to measure things accurately. So I bought a set of micrometers, and it's amazing the kind of stuff you can buy on Amazon now that would have been really expensive years ago. But now you can get a decent set of micrometers on Amazon for under $100. And all the tools are available to you pretty readily online. And it's been totally awesome. So I'm one of those people that if I do electronics all day, I like to go home and then work on something else. Like I need to have kind of a change. And the kit business is, I mean, to be honest, that's largely like manufacturing. It's
logistics
not so
is
much
my hobby.
Electronics.
Oh, yeah.
It totally is logistics. No, that's actually very true.
I browse
Digi-Key really
when I'm feeling stressed after a long day of work.
But I mean, finding a new supplier for a component, that is like supply chain. It's different than a lot of the stuff I do during the day. And so I get to spend time doing that stuff at night and emailing suppliers for plastics and things like that. But then I also like to do kind of the totally unrelated stuff. And for me, it's always been kind of the mechanical is a really nice way to change things up. So I do electronics design during the day. I get to wrench on cars and stuff at nights and on the weekends. And it's been a huge amount of fun. But man, is it a time commitment? It's pretty intense.
Now, getting back to the kit thing, because I know there's a lot of people who will want to know details on this. I'm not sure if we've discussed it when you've been on before. What techniques are you using to actually sort out the components and manufacture these kits? Do you have like a separate little those red little bins for each part, and then do you do 10 at once, 20 or 50, or do you do the whole batch at once? How do you handle all that?
That's a good question. I've seen some of the other pros do it. Like I've been to Adafruit and I've seen how they do it. And I think Lady Ada has done videos on how they do kitting.
Oh, okay. Right.
I've done it pretty much the same way since I started doing the Geiger counter kits, at least. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty simple. But the thing I do is I've got a big kitchen table, and it's kind of a larger than a normal kitchen table. And it's really important to have a huge work surface.
Oh, yeah.
And I've got a series of bowls. I actually like bowls. Like they're plastic bowls, and mm-hmm. they have kind of a chamfer on one corner, which means that it's easy to pour stuff out of them, which is really nice.
Yeah.
For small components.
Yep.
So I've got, and they're like Dixie bowls. They're like really cheap kind of red plastic bowls. And it just happened to be what I had at the time I started this. I didn't buy them for this project or this purpose. But I do one component per bowl, which means that if a component is like two per on the bomb, there's actually two bowls.
Oh,
that way
okay.
you just
right.
pull,
you
pull
miss.
One component
right.
from
yep.
each bowl. You don't have to like think about it too much.
Right.
Yep. And I basically put exactly 100 parts typically into each bowl. So I build in batches of 100. Which
and you've
I
got
found,
to manually count those or you weigh them and then...
I use a weighing counting yep. scale. And I gotta say, Adafruit uses the counting scale, and that's how I learned about it. I've had it for quite a while. It's pretty cheap. There are many components, though, that do not count well. And one of
yes.
the ones I found, which is annoying, is resistors.
Uh-huh.
Through-hole resistors, for whatever reason, at least the ones I buy, are not super consistent in terms of weight. And that means that you're always going to be either have too many or too few. So for those I manually count, and I actually just kind of line them all up, and I do groups of like 5 or 10 and just count them off. And it's tedious, but that's the kind of stuff you can do while you're watching TV. You don't really need to think too hard about it. But the basic idea is that by putting exactly 100 parts into each bowl, if at the end of building all of these kits you've got extra parts, that's when you've got to actually sort through
start
and
over.
Look at all the bags. And well, no, I mean, I've actually gotten pretty good at like
weigh the bag. And
no,
what
you can't do that.
One? No, you can't.
You can't do that. No, because there's a few parts, like any kind of components on cut tape. The weight varies by more than a resistor's worth
of
weight.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, ESD foam is also, like, I don't always cut it exactly the same.
Right.
So there's a few sources of variability, but I think even if you looked at the weight variability of each of the components and added all that up and did a statistical distribution, you'd find that the uncertainty is greater than a resistor.
Yeah, exactly.
Because resistors weigh almost nothing. Like, it's really hard to discern one resistor. But that's what I've been doing for, I guess, about 3 years now, and it's worked amazingly well. And I think of all the kits I've sold, I've had maybe one or two examples of screw-ups where I missed a part and I didn't find it in my kind of double-checking process.
Right. Well, that's not too bad. Out of how many units do you think you've shipped now?
Thousands and thousands. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know what the exact number is. I should go look it up. But I crossed a couple thousand, I think well over, gosh, probably 2 years ago, I had already crossed like 2,000.
Yeah, you probably just look at your tube orders, right? One per kit.
Yeah, exactly. I used to keep closer track of it, but now I don't have as much time to do kind of the analytics. But I used to actually plot prices over time and make sure that, for a while, the Geiger tubes were getting more and more expensive as the demand just got crazier and crazier after Fukushima. Like, before Fukushima, you could get Geiger tubes for, like, almost nothing. Like, they were very inexpensive. And then all of a sudden, everybody wanted Geiger tubes. And for a while, I was really nervous that I wasn't going to be able to afford making kits anymore because the prices for tubes just kept going up and up. And I was buying in, like, bigger and bigger quantities to try to get around that. Fortunately, things are not as crazy anymore, and I find that
the market
I'm in
crashed.
That situation.
The tube market crashed.
The tube market actually did
the
not.
The great tube market crash in 2013.
I told my broker the market, to sell them all off, man.
The market
terrible.
Didn't actually. It didn't crash. It's actually one of those things that's still a desirable part. Everybody wants Geiger counter tubes for lots of projects, but it's definitely gotten less crazy than it was, which means that I can be more confident in pricing because it's more stable. But it's still not at the levels that it was before I started all this stuff. It's just crazy to see how supply and demand works.
And how many units would you pack at one time?
100?
Like 100 per bowl? You'd sit down and do 100?
I'll do 100. 100 is about as many as I would want to do in one sitting. Like at the end of 100, your eyes are getting kind of bleary and you're starting to get kind of sore. And that's when I start daydreaming about making robots to do all of this automatically so that I don't have to do it. But 100 is about as much time as you can do like in one sitting. Mm-hmm. And I've done like 200 and maybe even 300 in a weekend before. And at the end of that weekend, you're just totally wiped out. That's a lot of work.
Resist
a lot of
stab wounds and all your fingers and you're just, your lead content's up. And,
there's kind of silly things that end up being a problem. Like the ESD bags that I use, if you handle one of them, it's not obvious, but if you handle 100 of them, they're a little bit sticky. And at the end of 100, it's your hands are sticky, and it ends up being like harder and harder to separate the bags. So there's kind of like comedic things that at scale you would never know would be a problem. But I think in general, like I have to say, if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it. Obviously, so it's something that it's quite a lot of work, but it's really enjoyable. Like I was trying to think recently of like why do I not just give all this work to someone else and pay somebody to actually do all the hard work of like stuffing the bags? But I think at the end of the day, like it's extremely relaxing work. Like enjoy kind of carrying the product all the way and actually like everyone that builds a kit, they know like I painstakingly built this with my own hands and I did everything. And actually I should give my wife credit because she does a lot of the work also. She helps quite a bit. I've drafted her into this and she's been great about it. And she kind of knows exactly what to do as well as I do. But if I didn't enjoy kind of that feeling of like making this kind of bespoke item, I don't think I would do it. It would be,
Totally. Yeah.
Just more work.
You have to be crazy to do it.
Well, hey, man, if this whole kid thing doesn't work out for you and this whole Valve thing doesn't work out for you, I hear that Dave is hiring, so, I mean, you could probably go and make kit for him if you just moved to Australia, and then, you know, you could just work over there, so...
I've had a few people ask me if I would do design for kits, and I would love to do that, honestly. I need to find a way of calling my projects, but I would love to do more kit design, and I've got a few ideas for kits of my own that I'd like to build. But one of the things I'll say, you know, to people that do this and have a day job, when I started doing this, I was doing freelancing, I was writing the book, I had a lot of free time, and I was able to spend a huge amount of time at the outset to kind of get this whole business going. I cannot imagine doing all of that while also having a pretty demanding full-time job. For people that do that, that started it while they were working, like I know Garrett Mace did that while he was working full-time. There's a number of people that have started this and all also had a full-time job. I have a huge amount of respect for people that do that. It's just the only reason I'm able to keep this going is because I started it kind of before I got so busy in general. And so as a result, it's really hard to do new kits because that takes a lot of time. Like one of the interesting things about being a manufacturer is that the more things you design, there's sort of this like limit of like, you can't keep manufacturing and do new design, which was one of the things about Adafruit that amazes me is that Adafruit, they've got a manufacturing business, but they're also designing new stuff. As somebody that has like a couple kits, like two kits that sell.
Exactly.
It's really hard. Like it's hard to scale. And I think that's actually true.
When you've got like a couple of hundred employees, it makes it easier.
Gosh, but at the same time, though, if you're like the owner operator, you think about somebody like Lamore, like she's a manager also. She owns a company. Mm. She's got to manage this company. So I mean, it's not like it scales arbitrarily and where there's no additional impact to hiring like the 101st person. Mm. There is going to be some impact. Now, granted, it's going to be definitely less than hiring like the first person where you've got to tell them what to do and you build structure, right? But it's still, I think any manufacturer has this challenge in that it is... You're sort of beholden to the products that you've already designed and that are shipping, and that sort of makes it harder for you to continue innovating and continue making new stuff. And I've definitely experienced that for Mighty Ohm because it's very hard to kind of find that time to do new stuff while also working all the time to fulfill existing orders. That's a challenge for, I think, any small business.
Totally.
Well, yeah, man. Dave's about to go number one. He's about to, hire number one soon.
Yeah, get number one. And because I've been really doing it solo for 20 years. You know, I've had a kit business for 20 years before all this open source hardware rubbish came along.
Oh, yes.
When I was a boy, I was packing and shipping kits and, you know, typing with a typewriter, you know. Typing the addresses on the labels, you know.
Old.
I was fully computerized back then, 20 years ago, you know. I would have my dot matrix printer printing out labels, you know, you could buy labels on the reels, you know, and then you stick them in your little 9-pin dot matrix printer and you could print out address labels. Automation. Woohoo. And I'm going to hire another one. I was surprised actually at that. Like, this is something that I didn't consider, right? I thought like, It barely even crossed my mind that anyone from overseas would bother applying. But, like, more than half the applicants are from overseas. And I'm going,
how does the visa process work?
Exactly. How does that work? Do you, like, these people are, you know, like I can't blame them, right? They're fans or whatever, and they, you know, they really want to, you know, come work here, and that's great. But unfortunately, it's the logistics of the whole thing, you know? And, because I've heard that getting a working visa here in Australia is pretty horrific. And then, you know, there's a lot of paperwork at my end as well, you know, hiring someone with a work visa or something. And they, you know, send people around to audit you to make sure they're not illegal workers and all that sort of jazz. And it's just, it's just not going to work, let alone how am I going to interview you, you know? Video interviews suck. And, so, unfortunately, it's just not going to work out. So, and also, I feel kind of selfish, right? Because I I put on my job description that I'm an equal opportunity employer, right? And I didn't think that that would, you know, I thought, yeah, I definitely am, right? I'm not going to discriminate against anyone for whatever, but ultimately I am, because I really want to hire a local, you know, somebody local.
Oh, and, well, that's not what that term means, Dave.
Yeah, I know it's not what that term means, but it kind of, you know, it's a bit ironic. I put that in there and I'm going to, you know, kind of sorry to those who applied from overseas, but pretty much automatically rule you out, because I much prefer to hire a local and support local talent. I just feel much better about that.
I think that's a totally reasonable requirement.
Yeah,
you just
I
say,
think
like,
totally
must
yeah.
be eligible to work in Australia,
must
you know,
speak
whatever.
Australian.
Must speak Australian, yeah. And I think one person had a working visa, and, you know, that might be okay, but, like, yeah. I still, even in that case, I still prefer to give it to a local, I think, just because, well, you know, I was born here, I spent my whole life here, and I sort of want to help support the local
industry. Yeah, you wish you would have had this when you were a kid, right?
I mean, industry, like, right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I want to give a local a start, not somebody from overseas, and when they're finished, well, they're just going to go back overseas. I mean, you know,
that, you buy a
that
house
could happen
here,
to the
you
local.
Can work for Dave.
Right. Yeah. And learn bugger all and earn bugger all.
Right.
And, but, you know, that could happen to a local too, right? You know, they could work here and then bugger off overseas, right? But, hey, you know, the odds are they probably won't. They'll, you know, continue to get a job locally, and it helps, you know, support the industry and all that sort of stuff. So would you guys say that I'm right by doing that?
Oh, I'm way behind you, man, on that. I think that's totally legit. Cool. I think logistically, I think, you know, supporting your local community, all those things are good things. I think you're going to catch a lot of crap for it, but, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah, I'll cop some crap, I'm sure. Yeah. You know,
you're Dave.
Some people...
I would say that if you can, if there is a candidate that's not local, that's willing to take all of the burden of making it easy for you, then that's kind of where you'd say, all right, well, this guy, he went like the extra mile because he got the visa on his own. He figured out how to get sponsored. He came over.
Yeah.
You know, like that's how you're going to separate the folks that like really, really want to do this versus the like, it would be cool to work with Dave Jones.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they don't give a thought to the practicality.
Yeah,
you
know, terrible yeah. working with Dave. Are you kidding yourself?
You know.
Come on, man.
No, I would probably consider the person who has a working visa, right? Especially like,
yeah.
you know, if they're much better than everyone else, if they're the ideal candidate, then yeah, I'm probably going to take them on, right? I'm not going to take on somebody who's crap just because they're local.
Here's my take on all this, right? No offense to you, Dave, but
that's right.
You never want to be the first hire. No one wants to be the first hire. You want to be like the third or fourth hire. Let them work out all the kinks on something
right.
else, right?
Really?
I mean, like, because that's what it is. It's messy, you know? Once you've had, like, I was the...
Oh, yeah, totally.
I was
totally.
The third co-op on my first co-op position. I was the third one. They had mostly figured out kind of the, well, what do we do with a kid who isn't actually an engineer
right.
yet kind of thing.
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah.
that's a tough thing to do, right? I mean, it's the
first
one.
I have no idea what I'm going to do. I'm going
right.
to get him in here, and we're just going to go, well, what do we do now?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
We'll probably stare at each other and go, I don't know.
Right. So people from overseas, give it one or two, you know, let Dave figure it out. Let him screw up
right,
the first
right.
two or three. And yeah.
As the empire expands, right, and I'm moving
right,
to bigger
course.
Dibs, and, you know,
yeah.
Like, yeah.
There's
right.
no stock options in EEV blog. Don't worry about that. You're not getting any early.
Oh, no,
there's,
no.
There's no ground floor. In the ground floor
right,
is the new
right.
is the new bunker that Dave bought. It's not. It's not anything glamorous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love know. It. Yep.
Well, how is the scene up in Seattle, right? We heard a little bit about Seattle when you moved up there and stuff like that. Are you finding, like, are there swap meets up there? Are there hardware events at all? Because, I mean, obviously, Seattle is a huge software town, but are you seeing kind of hardware in the area?
A little bit. So I've learned a bit more since the last time we talked. I've lived here longer. There's actually probably the biggest event of the year is there's a ham radio swap meet. That's in Kent, which is pretty close to Seattle and close to Bellevue, where I work. And that's the Mike and Key Amateur Radio Club swap meet. And I went last year, or sorry, this year. It's held in, I think it's March every year. And I actually went there with Alan Yates and Monty, and we actually registered all together as sellers, and we got a couple tables next to each other.
Oh, nice.
And I sold more electronics than I ever would have imagined. Like, I literally filled my car with stuff, and I'd say that over half of it sold, which was way better than I thought I was going to do. And that's probably one of the biggest sort of hardware-y geeky events that happens in terms of electronics. It's a really, really good swap meet, and I think it's one of the biggest ones in this area. So that was a great discovery. I learned about that. I think I got a flyer or something in the mail, and decided if I was going to go, I might as well sell. And it was totally cool.
Yeah, you're not getting emails about swap meets, man. You're getting like no, actually, someone going to your door, or like an old guy coughing, and you hear about, you know, swap meet.
I find it really endearing. Like I actually enjoy amateur radio, at least in the Seattle area, is a somewhat antiquated group. Like,
yeah,
these are mostly
the Boeing
older
guys,
folks,
right?
That have been doing this a long time. and I actually find that really charming. I it's kind of fun to actually mail in an application to a swap meet with a check, and you get your notification on a little card that you have to bring with you.
Paper.
But I will say, actually, the Maker Faire would learn a lot from this group.
Oh, yeah?
This group, the Mike and Key Amateur Radio Club, it was the best organized event in terms of like loading and unloading of stuff than I've ever seen in my life. And maybe that is like there's a Boeing connection or something, but basically you pull up with your car, and your car is full of test equipment and heavy stuff and everything. You are responsible for unloading your car onto a pallet, and then that pallet gets a number, and it's your table number, and then it disappears. The pallet just goes away.
Wow.
And you pull out. So like you go into a turnout, you unload your stuff in like 10 minutes, you drive away, you go park, and then it's going to take you like a half hour to get back to the site. You can go get coffee, go get breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
And you go to your table, and your stuff is there.
That's nice.
They actually transport
that is
all
nice.
Your stuff to the table. And then you unload it off the pallet, and then they come by later and they put the pallet away so it's not, you know, in the way. I was amazed. Like, and I should have said something to the Maker guys, because I saw Dale this year at the Maker Faire, and I saw a bunch of the Maker guys. Like, what a cool idea. Like, these guys, in terms of manpower, it was a lot of people. Like, it was a huge amount of work for them to pull it off. But it was so cool to not have to worry about, like, what am I going to do with my car? Like, mm-hmm. Where am I going to park that I'm going to be able to carry or use a dolly? Do I have to go buy a dolly to move all this stuff into this building? Because I was on, like, the second floor of a pretty big building.
Oh, okay.
And they took care of
all that
stuff.
It rains a lot in Seattle. I was like, why aren't you guys just outside in a parking lot?
Yeah, I know.
Like, Dave does this with the boot stuff,
right? We don't do the outdoor anything here, really. and I say this as it's pouring rain, as it often does here. No, an outdoor swap meet, I think that would be like a joke. That would be like the swap meet that they send the newbies to like,
right, yeah.
Oh, you go to the, you can go to the parking lot sale.
I got an email
like
about
off.
The outdoor swap meet.
And it'll be all the noobs will be in the parking lot, and they'll be soaked. That's not a thing here. So it's actually at the I think like county fairgrounds or something like that in Kent. And that was really cool. I enjoyed that a lot. And I think Monty and Alan had a good time too.
Well, that's totally different to the one I went to. I sold some stuff as well, but it was a car boot sale. You drove your car in to the area, you found a parking spot, you laid a sheet out, or you could leave the stuff in the boot if you really wanted to. Oh, sorry, trunk for you. you know, a trunk sale or whatever you want to call it. And yeah, so you just put a sheet down on the ground and you just, you know, take all the stuff out of your boot and lay it down and there it is.
Some of the classier folks have tables too, yeah.
Oh, well, you're fancy.
Highfalutin. Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
That's kind of how the Silicon Valley one is, the one at De Anza.
Right.
Yeah. Is sort of like that. Like, there's a lot of guys selling stuff out of their pickup trucks, and, you know, they get a... I think they're, like, the preferred thing is you have, like, a blanket that you put on the ground, and you cover the blanket with your stuff.
Yep.
And if you're, like, primo, you've got a table.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Something
That's
about
exactly
tables.
That's exactly what this is.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, like, the year before I did this, apparently, like, it was actually rained out, you know, so like everyone just, there basically was hardly any car boot sales that day because, yeah, it was just raining. So that sucked.
If we did that, we would never get to do anything.
Right. Yeah, it rains a lot in Seattle. I know.
It does, although not as much as people make it out to. And actually, this year was probably one of the driest years in the past, like, 20 or so. So we had an awesome summer this year.
Seattle is a really nice place in the summer. Yeah, I've been to Seattle, and it actually didn't rain that much. So, yeah, I was surprised. Like, everyone said, you got to have your umbrella, take it everywhere. You know, and I went, well, no, I didn't really need one. You know,
it depends. Yeah, exactly. It depends.
So, then again, I was only there for, like, 2 days or something. So, you know.
Yeah, you know, apart from the Mike and Key show, I haven't found too much. I know there's a couple meetups, but I haven't had the time to really check out all of the meetups that are in town. There's another amateur radio conference. I guess amateur radio is probably the biggest in terms of the hardware scene here. And I actually saw Michael Osmond's talk at the Tapper TAPR.
Oh, that's right. He was up there for that.
Right.
Yeah. And I wish I could have talked to him because he had just been on the show and I wanted to meet him. And I was really sick that day. Like, I dragged myself over to the show. I was feeling like horrible. And so I was like, oh, I'm just not going to be contagious. So I went, I sat away from everybody else. I checked it out. And then I like disappeared immediately
in the
after that.
I'm Mighty Ohm. Sorry.
<Yeah. laughs> but it was a cool talk, and that's another event that I know folks in this area really look forward to is Microsoft has a similar conference called, I think it's like Micro Hams, and I think it's also very digital radio-y.
Yeah.
So I think this year there were actually like two conferences that were pretty good, and I only got to go to the Tapar one, but it was great.
Is that the one that's way up in the sound, like on the far coast? Because Mike's told me about that one. I always forget which one it is, or maybe that's SmooCon.
So Tapar. Oh,
that's the one that's like on the very far. There's one that's on,
that's TourCon.
TourCon. That's
so
it.
TourCon. I went the first year that I lived here. I think it's one of those like every other year events, and it's a camping themed event. So you bring all your tent and a bunch of stuff out to. It literally is one of the most westernmost parts of the country.
In like, northern, it's like the upper left corner of the states. It's like you look over and it's like, hey, there's Canada.
So the funny thing is that, you know, you're already pretty up and left being in Seattle, and then you have to drive like 5 hours to get out there.
Right.
Like, it's way out there. And I went the first year that I lived here, and it was super fun. It's absolutely beautiful out there. Like, the drive itself was really neat. We got to take a ferry, which was cool. And that was a good scene. And I met a few folks that are local that I've sort of kept in touch with since then. And it was a nice way to meet people, having just recently moved to the area. But I didn't go this year. Unfortunately, I was super busy that time of year when it happened. I think it's in like the late summer, early fall.
Yeah, like the only time you want to be up there in
that's probably kind of true.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, well, I guess there's weird stuff in Washington State too, with all like the windward and wayward side, right? Isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
right.
You get on one side of the mountain, it's like desert, and the other side is like super rainy kind of shit.
No, it really is. One of the things I've been wanting to do since I moved and I haven't gotten around to yet is go to Hanford. There's a nuclear site where they made plutonium for quite a long time. I think it's the most polluted area in the country in terms of like a Superfund site.
So they're taking your wife there for
the
like
worst.
For a honeymoon.
Well, I mean, you just go for a short amount of time. It's really about cumulative exposure. But I think they've done a lot of work to try to improve the quality of the environment there. But this is the Hanford, reactor where they did a lot of the plutonium for during the atomic program and Los Alamos and all that stuff. And so they give tours. And that is in eastern Washington, which is in that weird deserty area. And it's like several hours away from here. It's quite a long drive, but it's a really interesting drive. And you get to see really beautiful, dramatic country that's not representative of what you would think like Washington looks like. Like, it's not all pine or evergreen trees. It's like rolling deserty hills. And I drove through there on the way out here from Texas, and I've always wanted to go back. So hoping that I get to do that
I'm imagining you going out there and then like being like, sir, did you bring something with you? Is your pocket beeping right now? So, I'm testing my Geiger counter.
I would totally bring one of the kits if I went out there. Yeah. I might even bring a few of them in
musical
and
yeah.
give them to people. There, it's the thing about that area is that I think this was sort of in that era of the military in the United States, where if you were done using something, you poured it into the ground.
Yeah,
and that's sort of that. This is part of that whole thing. And I think there are holding vats for enriched uranium and plutonium in the ground, and the vats have like become porous because they were made of steel and they rusted, and so all that stuff went into the ground. And of course, there's a major river that goes through there, and so that's not good. But apparently, I'm told that they're working on that.
But don't worry, that goes further south.
Cool. they're going to, yeah. But it's supposed to be really neat. You can actually see the B reactor, which I think has been restored. And so folks have told me that have went out there that it's really impressive. So Seattle's actually got a few, or I guess that's Washington, but this area, there's a few sites like that. You know, you've got the Boeing tour, you've got... that mm-hmm. there's a computer museum in downtown Seattle that opened up that Paul Allen started that has a pretty big collection of old computer hardware, both large and small. And the cool thing about it compared to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View is that you can touch all of it.
Oh,
they actually let you enter programs on a teletype machine that's connected to a PDP. And you can actually sit in there like a whole day. You could actually buy a ticket, go in the morning, stay the whole day, and goof around on a wide variety of old computer equipment. So it's really neat. Yeah. Seattle's got a bunch of stuff like that. Sometimes it's been a little hard to find those things, but I've been really pleasantly surprised.
Helps when you have lots of nerds with money.
Paul, I swear, like the Microsoft guys, in one way or another, there's quite a few. There's like a World War II aircraft museum up in Everett, I think, or near the Boeing factory that I think is also Paul Allen or one of the other Microsoft guys.
Might be Charles Simonyi or someone like that who's been into space. He paid like...
I'm not sure.
Oh, is he one of the guys that went on the $20 million to get on that rocket?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yep. That was Charles, yeah.
Crazy.
He was one of the early ones. He's the one who developed Microsoft Office for those history. Yep.
Did he have anything to do with the game that's or the Easter egg in Excel? Isn't there like a flight simulator in Excel?
Oh, possibly. That's stretching my, I don't know. But no, that might be after his time. He worked on, you know, the very early implementations. Bill Gates, if you want to know your history, Bill Gates hired him because he did his master's or PhD thesis on ways to implement, you know, software management and all that sort of, you know, compiler, you know, design and all that sort of jazz. So, he invented his own method for doing software development and Bill read his thesis and went, yeah, that's how we want to do things at Microsoft. And apparently they tried to implement it and found it didn't work that great in practice. But, hey, he's a smart guy anyway.
Yeah.
You know. So. There you go.
Did you guys see this Intel 1405 that Ken Scherf did this week? He cut down a picture internal like of the die. Crazy old RAM chip kind of thing. I don't know if you guys.
That was a shift register memory, right?
Yeah.
That's far out.
1970s vintage. Yeah. What sort of process geometry was that?
I have no idea. Big.
Like 5 micron or something. You know.
Yeah. Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Very cool. I love those teardowns. Yeah, once again, done the overlays on there to show you how it works and stuff like that. So that's really quite neat. Very nice. We'll definitely link that one in. I'd love to do stuff like that, but, you know, the chemicals to, you know, etch away at these, and you really need a proper microscope. You know, you can't dick around.
You can get, like, an X-ray machine, put it in your new space, Dave. You could...
I'll just bid on one of those 100 X-ray machines that are always coming up on eBay here in Australia. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess you have fewer of those, huh? Yeah.
I know they're dime a dozen in the States, but here, you know, stuff like that is rare as hen's teeth.
Yeah.
You know, I would love to, because I've got room to put stuff like that now. It'd be fantastic, but but they never come up. You know, I've had a few things, you know, over the last couple of years. I've got, oh, I wish I could bid on that, but I can't because I've got nowhere to bloody put the thing, you know. So, but yeah, I've never seen an X-ray machine come up. That's for sure.
Maybe you could buy one here and we'll just like charter a boat and you can have like the nerd cruise, like
the,
shipping
the slow
it over
boat
to Australia.
From Yankee Land.
Yeah.
Oh goodness,
Jeff! You got any? You pick up any sweet gear when you're at these swap that swap meet thing? Did you any see any?
I picked up a Hameg digital / analog oscilloscope on the last swap meet I was at, and it was one of those ones. It's actually got like a analog front end, and you can use it in full analog mode, or you push a button and then it becomes kind of a basic mega sample-y digital storage scope. And it's kind of a neat scope. I got it mostly out of a curiosity and because I kind of wanted an analog scope for home because I only had a digital. And it was super cheap because all of the front panel knobs had stopped working. It'd become really intermittent, and it uses rotary encoders.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so I got it home, and I pulled it apart, and sure enough, it used a rotary encoder that I could buy on DigiKey, of all places. Like, it was a very common part.
Right.
And so I stripped the whole thing apart, and Hameg was actually nice enough. They sent me a full service manual for it also.
Excellent.
And so I pulled it apart, replaced all the rotary encoders, and it's like a brand new scope. Like, it looked like it had never been used. It had just been stored, and I guess moisture had gotten into the switches or whatever.
Right.
And so I picked that guy up, and I'm pretty happy with that. I've been playing around with that guy. Picked up some old vintage Heathkit stuff, a lot of which I've since sold because I realized I didn't need that much old Heathkit stuff.
Yeah, it's always so like old, it's so tempting when you go to the swap stuff. Meets and the ham fest and stuff like that, and it's like, oh, that's so cool looking and old, and you're like,
yeah,
and I have like $300 scope that's better than that, you know what I mean? Like, it's just
exactly, that's 100 times better. Yeah,
right.
It's pointless.
I keep buying these like little baby oscilloscopes, like Ico had, I think it's like the 435 or 400 series. There's these Ico, I think they were kits that were sold in the 60s and 70s, and they've got a little like 3-inch CRT. They're tube based,
very cute.
And they're really kind of cute and small, and I keep buying them because they're always like $5 and I'm buying them kind of hoping that at some point I will do a tube based scope project and maybe just turn them into like art. So I've got a little collection of these guys, but that's like that kind of thing that you start buying them and then they start piling up.
Yeah, man,
on
I got
the shelf
a pile of art
now
in my basement too.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's that's not junk, honey. It's art.
Yeah,
trust
it's art.
Me.
I'm an artist.
Well, it's
dear.
It's not art yet, but right. Well, hopefully at one time when it's not like taken apart and covered in like 40 years of like sludge and grime, hopefully it will be art. I have to say, like, I'm probably, compared to folks that I know, I'm a little better about not collecting large amounts of stuff like that. So when I go to the swap meet, I actually bring a lot of stuff to sell. And
I'm like, stuff that
I don't want to be hauling around. Because I've moved a few times over the past few years for work or whatever. And every time I've tried to like get rid of stuff, but I've kept certain things. Now it's like, if it's not made before like the 2000s, maybe I'm not going to hang on to it. Because it just stuff like that starts to get kind of flakier and flakier.
Yeah.
And when you need it to turn it on and just kind of work, it's hard. There's some test equipment that I've got on my wish list that I'm hoping I can come across some good used ones at some point, but I'm probably not going to find it at a swap meet. I've really fallen in love with Agilent's 4000 series. Well, sorry, Keysight. Keysight's.
So you're just hoping you're going to come across a scope that came out like 5 years ago or something. And just,
well, I mean,
just
there is a used market
of the
for
price,
that.
Right? Yeah.
There is a used market for that stuff.
The 4000 is very sexy to look at, but it's a pretty disappointing because it's essentially just the 3000 with a bigger screen and some touch.
That's not true.
I've got one at work.
So I got one for my office at work about a year ago.
What's the extra functionality that has that the 3000 doesn't?
So first of all,
Dave, I would like to request you to review.
It's got zone triggering.
So the zone triggering is awesome. Yeah, and I've used it a bit. The touch screen is actually the surprising feature that I thought the touch screen would be kind of a joke when I got it. Like, oh, this is really silly. Like, everything's got to be all mobile phony and be touch. The touch screen is awesome. Like, it is, I use it every single day. It is totally killer. But the thing that really sold me on that scope is that the scope can actually do high-speed USB packet data analysis, triggering, and signal quality. So you can actually, you can do USB inrush current testing, you can do USB mask testing, but more than that, you can actually do... but I mean, think about the number of like USB devices that people are developing, particularly in the professional world. Everything's USB, right? So there's a lot of reason to want to be able to look at bit by bit and packet by packet USB. And I'd say that just based on those features alone, that's enough of a reason why you'd want one over a 3000 series. And the 3000 series is a great scope, but man, once you get that big LCD and you get the touch screen,
yeah, but it's
and you
the
get
same
all the
resolution.
Stuff,
that's the thing that pisses me off. It's still the same 800 by 600 resolution,
you know,
as the 3000.
That's true, and that's because of KeySight.
The ASIC in it.
I still have trouble saying KeySight.
Yeah, I know. It's just
Agilent. HP's. Yeah, HP's, the engineering that HP and Agilent and KeySight, they made that chip, right? And that chip does all the heavy lifting. But I think that I haven't found that to be a problem, really. It's a beautiful scope. So I'm waiting for those to become available on the used market, and I'd love to pick one up. I actually feel like between that scope and the KeySight FieldFox combination network analyzer, spectrum analyzer.
That's really nice, yeah.
You could totally start, like, those two tools, and there's so many free design tools for RF design now. Like, you could totally start an RF, like, consulting business with just that equipment, because they're so incredibly capable.
Since we're going to get, we're going to get the question. We're going to get the question. What are those tools, just so we can list them out, so people can go, because come on,
So that the RF design tool that I've spent a bit of time, so there's LTSpice, of course, which is incredibly useful mostly for analog, and I think people have done RF design in LTSpice, which I'm pretty impressed by. But there's a tool called QUCS, which stands for Quite Universal Circuit Simulator. Have you used that before?
No, I've seen you tweeting about it.
Oh, it's awesome. It's totally awesome.
How do you say it, though? Is it Quux?
Quux?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Go Quux.
But between that tool and like HP's old AppCAD, which is kind of a microstrip calculator tool that you can use to do some simple stuff, that's been around forever. This QUCS program, you could totally do like filter synthesis, impedance matching networks, all that kind of stuff using free tools. And it is amazing. Like, you can actually capture STP files, which are S parameter data files, using the FieldFox, and then copy them over to your PC, and then actually open those up in Quux and use that to synthesize matching networks. It's amazing. Like, I didn't know about that tool more than about a year ago. I wish I had found out about it years ago. It's been around for a while. And actually, there was a presentation by one of the guys that developed there's a low-cost European network analyzer. It's one of those primarily kind of hobbyist oriented, I think it's like 1 gigahertz ish maximum bandwidth network analyzer. I wish I could remember the gentleman's name, but there was a presentation he gave at a conference that listed a bunch of kind of free tools for like filter synthesis and RF design. And it's getting pretty impressive. Like, it used to be where you needed ADS or Microwave Office to really do any kind of RF design. And I think you still kind of need those tools to do like professional level design if that's what you're doing all day. But on the other hand, you can do a pretty impressive amount with an Excel spreadsheet and some of these free design tools. And I've been really impressed. I've also done a bit of antenna simulation using NEC. Like, there's a bunch of variants of NEC around, which is a really old school antenna simulation package. There's one called, I think it's like Easy NEC or 4 something Easy NEC. There's a bunch of Windows-based derivatives of that. And I've used that to synthesize some kind of simple PCB-mounted antennas and had actually really good results. So I've been just amazed by the quality of it, you know, and they're not the easiest to use, but they get the job done.
Awesome.
Great, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had someone
we
asking.
We had a couple of segues back there, but very quickly, because we're almost out of time.
Sorry,
speaking of art and Heathkits, we had a link on the forum. I tweeted this one as well, to some awesome electronic art. Check it out.
Yeah, the clock.
It's just,
man, that thing was beautiful.
The clock. Yeah, the clock.
A little
and
too
the
late
other
for Christmas
one.
To build this for someone, but maybe for next year someone can.
It's a bit late. Yeah, I'd love to know how many hours work he put into this, but geez, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
It's stunning. Yeah. Maybe we can have that as our banner photo for this episode or something.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, and also there's some Heathkit controversy.
We were talking about that.
We were talking about
that's right.
Heathkit, and apparently there's a thing on Artifruit, about the history of the Heathkit and how they can't restart, and they restart again, and how nobody can find out any info about the person who's doing it, and sounds all dodgy, and
I think Jeff kind of got to the point of it, too. It's like, you know, the magic of it was you were building a kit. That was a good thing. The downside was you were building it because you had to, because there wasn't really many other options.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But these days, there's so many good options.
Oh, so many cheap test instruments. That's why I wouldn't wouldn't do a piece of test gear as a kit these days. It's just there's so few people that are going to want to build it. Really.
Right. I mean, you'll learn something if you build it, right? There's always that.
Oh, yeah, totally. But
that's what
makes
it tough.
It's not like it was back in the old days when the electronics magazines, all they were filled with was test equipment projects, you know, because, if you built your own, you know, it was great.
You know,
I sold thousands of my digital storage scope kit because back then, right, you couldn't buy a digital storage scope, right? So you built your own. And, you know, that was massively popular. And, yeah, I sold that for years, and geez, it was, totally different these days. So, you know, and why even build your own power supply these days?
Well,
unless it's something niche for your own requirement, you know,
maybe.
Because there's, you know, like a bit, you know, like just a simple, you know, 30 volt, 3 amp, you know, your regular 30 volt, 3 amp linear bench supply, you can get them for like $50 on eBay.
Yeah.
It's just, it's scary.
Oh, that's Dave's wife telling him it's time to go home for Christmas.
It's time to go home, folks.
Yeah, folks. All right, we need to end it. But Jeff, thank you for coming back. It was always great talking to you. And
yeah, thanks for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure.
Can't wait to hear what the heck is going on with your professional stuff. I'm sure we'll see stuff not at CES, as Dave was very
not
clear.
Not at right.
Nice. That was really suave, Dave, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. That's why I earn the big bucks.
Yeah.
There they are again. I'm
right. Serious.
It's because it is Christmas Eve here.
Yeah.
See you guys.
All right. Thanks. All see, right. You, see you, Jeff.
All right. Thanks. Bye.